and weird. So in other words, you know, they have different states. You know, sometimes they say the garden state, the flower state. Oregon is the weird state. And it's really nice allowing weird things to exist. Now I come from England, and England is known for its eccentrics and weird people. Every now and again you read about these really, really weird eccentrics in places like England. And there's one guy, he lives on his roof. Not inside the house, on his roof. 365 days a year. When it rains, when it snows, he's still on his roof. Totally mad, but incredibly healthy. It's weird. All those eccentrics who do strange, strange, strange things, it's incredible how healthy they are. So if you want to be healthy and live a long life, be weird. I think one of the reasons is because a person like that, they don't care what other people think of them. And imagine all that stress goes off you. You don't care what other people think of you. If you want to sleep on the roof of the cottage tonight, you just go up and do it. No stress, really happy. And that's why you live long. So anyway, deep inside you feel so touched and sad, your tears drop. It's just inspiration sometimes. And I don't know, sometimes that these are things from my past life. I still remember when I saw my first monk, you know, in this life. And I was in Cambridge in the university. And I was just going to a talk, a Buddhist talk, and I saw this monk. And I can still remember it now. And it was just incredible, powerful. Wow! A real Buddhist monk. So there's something there in your past life. There's some things which just resonate just so strongly. And you see sort of, you know, if you've been a Buddhist before and you see a monk, wow! It's not just like seeing a policeman or just seeing sort of a rock star like seeing Mick Jagger down the street or something. This is much more powerful than that. It goes right deep inside of you, it's a long way back. So sometimes chanting can do that as well. Sometimes it just resonates with something really, really deep inside. Dear Ajahn, I had an FXXXING good time with Brown Bear Jr. today. So what does FXXXING spell? What does that mean? I am a very pure monk. I've lived a very, very protected lifestyle. Now I know what that means. But you had a good time with a brown bear, Junior, today. Think she has special... It's a she. And I've been cuddling it. No. It has special powers. No powers or special paws. I don't know who did this one, it's great. I had a very good time with Brown Bear Jr. today. Think she has special powers. My whole week of meditation was like SHIT, but just now I decided to change places to meditate and borrowed your bear. It was such a sweet and peaceful time. My neck and back, which usually hurts like hell, just stopped hurting. I know my neck is twisting in a weird position, but it feels good, and I'm so loving meditation now. Thank you, Ajahn, and thank you, Junior Bear. Brazilian hugs and metta. P.S. I learned something new today. Patience, patience, patience. Very good. That's actually why I put up this bear and cuddled it just before the chanting, because I want to teach by example. If you haven't done this yet, meditate with a bear. It just softens you up and just makes you feel really good. So you see, it worked. So any of you whose meditation's been like SHIT, bear is there for you. I tend to have trouble forgiving someone who harms me if there is no acknowledgement from them that they've done something wrong. Maybe it's because I feel that if I act like everything is okay, they'll do it again. What should be the best approach? The best approach is that never allow other people to control your happiness. If you wait for something back from them, you may be waiting forever. Because a lot of time people don't think they've done anything wrong. You see they've done something wrong, and that's your perception. They see that you've done something wrong. That's their perception, which is why we have arguments and why we have wars, and it keeps going on and on and on. So your job, don't worry about them. Your job is to forgive and let go. It's not dependent upon what another person does. If another person wants to stay being angry, that's their business. If they've done something bad, it's their bad karma. So you don't do anything. So because of that, this is what I heard from Ajahn Chah. And you don't just hear these things, you practice them. The old story, if somebody calls you a dog, what do? You look at your bottom to see if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. You know, you don't sort of go up and say, you call me a dog, why do you call me a dog? You're an idiot for calling me a dog, you've got no right to call me a dog, it's not right for you to call me a dog, it's unfair you call me a dog. And you realize you've just allowed them to call you a dog, don't know, 7 or 8 more times. Every time you remember it. When you figure that out, why do you keep sort of hurt from the past? It doesn't make any sense. Somebody said something to you or about you and you got offended. Why do you keep allowing that to stay with you? It's hurting yourself again and again. Someone got cheated or they cheated you. Every time you remember it, you are allowing them to hurt you again. So as for me, they can do whatever they like. People say something. Sometimes I misunderstand what they said. Sometimes I'm not going to go and make an investigation. Why did you say that? You know, what was your intention? What did you mean? Blah, 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 blah. That's just such a waste of time. I just let it go. I look, if someone criticizes me, says something wrong about me, I look, do I deserve that? Have I got a tail? And if I am a dog, say, thank you so much for pointing that out. I'll try not to do it again. But if I haven't got a tail, you just forget about it. Let it go. Because otherwise that you will keep the pain of the past again and again and again for such a long time. And that sort of doesn't sort of help you and it doesn't help others. There's too much anger, too much guilt, too much negativity in this world. And you can't wait for someone else to solve that problem. You have to do it yourself by just letting it go. Don't wait for acknowledgement. Venerable Ajahn Brahma, I want this question to let go from my head. Please explain in simple words how the Vijnanajna fool us. Vijnanajna fool us all the time? Vijnana fool us all the time. Okay. I think you mean the consciousness keeps turning you all the time. So the consciousness, number one, I mentioned this thing we call consciousness is in fact 6 different types of consciousnesses. So some years ago I developed the simile of the fruit salad. So imagine you're sitting in the dining room and a plate is in front of you and suddenly you see an apple appear. And the apple is there for a moment, it's followed, then it disappears and there's this quick pause of nothing, then a coconut appears. And then that disappears, another apple and then a coconut and then a banana appears. Then a banana is followed by a coconut, and another banana, another coconut. And then a cauliflower appears. Not really a fruit, but this is what I'm saying. Cauliflower appears, and then a mango appears. And then what was the last one? Maybe a pineapple. And every fruit is followed by a coconut. Now in this simile, the apple is a simile for your eye. Apple of the eye. Banana, your smell, nose. A cauliflower, ear. And what was in there? It's a mango for taste and a pineapple for bodily sensation. And these different fruits appear. Different sense consciousnesses. Absolutely different. Always followed by a coconut, mind consciousness. And these ones follow after another very fast. So what you actually experience is apple coconut, apple coconut, apple coconut, banana coconut, pineapple coconut, cauliflower coconut, cauliflower coconut. And it's because this coconut follows so quickly afterwards, it makes the different senses appear the same. Seeing and hearing, what have they got in common? Smelling, tasting, touching, what have they got in common with each other? They're actually totally different experiences, but because they're always followed by knowing, we call them all consciousness. And if we can only separate out this coconut We know what the coconut is. We know what mind consciousness is. And that's the job of the jhanas, which is pure mind consciousness, nothing else. So when it's pure, you can actually understand what it is. And then you start seeing that your conscious processes is always just seeing followed by knowing, seeing, knowing, seeing, knowing, seeing, knowing, smell, knowing, smell, knowing, smell, knowing, hearing, knowing, hearing, knowing, hearing, knowing. It's because the knowing follows after all these other consciousnesses, and we put them together, it appears the same. And because it appears the same, then we get deluded into thinking this consciousness is a continuous process. If we could actually see and discern the different consciousnesses, just like in the fruit salad simile, apple seeing, hearing is cauliflower, smelling is bananas, tasting is mangoes, touching is pineapple, and knowing is coconut. If you actually could see these different fruits or vegetables just appearing on our plate, one after the other, there's nothing continuous in there, they're totally different, with nothing going across. So the idea of you are consciousness doesn't hold. You can't maintain it anymore. You say, well, which consciousness am I? Am I the coconut or am I the apple? Which one of those is me? And they're so totally different. It just destroys your illusion that you are the one who's listening to me now. That you are the one who sees me. That you are the one who knows that you see. It destroys it when you see the six different types of consciousness. You can separate them out. And you can see that just when one appears, the other ones disappear. So that's what actually the Buddha tried to get you to do with the contemplating the six different types of consciousness. But most of us, they appear the same, because they're always followed by knowing. That's the problem. Next one. Dear Ajahn, I realize many children get autism. Why they can get autism? Now that's a very question I don't really know, because I'm not really a doctor. Autism is when they go very deep within themselves. I'm not quite sure why, but I mean, there was one story of an autistic birth of the Buddha before, and that was where the Buddha was born. I think he was born as a prince, and he was fully aware of his birth, and he said, I don't want to be a prince. I don't want to get involved with this life anymore. So he decided never to speak and never to react. To actually basically to act as an autistic person. And he said that's the only way he could get out of doing the job of a prince and a king, and making all the bad karma of having to execute people and torture people and all the other stuff which a king had to do in those days, running an army. Now that's a fascinating little story. A long time since I read it. People please correct me if I've got it wrong. But it was almost like the previous life of the Buddha was actually went so inside of himself he would not speak. Now, how can you actually understand that? I think when I was a young monk, I remember having a dream. And sometimes, because you were meditating a lot, the dreams were very vivid, and they may have given me a clue of what autism really was. I'm not sure, maybe it was just catatonia. But I had this dream that I was a young boy. And in the place where I was brought up, in the block of council flats in Acton, next to Shepherd's Bush, and there I was attacked by a group of kids, and I was knifed. And every time I was stabbed, it hurt so much that I just went deep inside of myself as the only place I could escape from the pain. And the last thing I remember was my mother running out screaming at these boys, and even though the boys were armed, a mother's love for her son knows no fear. And then just going very, very deep inside of myself and becoming catatonic for years. And it's an interesting dream, because what brought me out of that catatonia, this was a dream, nothing more than that, was actually being in some institution and just the kindness of a nurse, and the sound of a voice full of metta, been giving me that feeling of safety and security to bring me out of this deep place inside of myself where I was hiding through fear and coming out again. It's an amazing dream. I remember that, and maybe that gives you some insight into what happens to, especially catatonia, Life is just so painful, or you're afraid, so terribly afraid, so traumatized, you go so deep inside because that's the only place you can hide and protect yourself from intolerable pain. But the most interesting part of that dream, and the thing which I always remember, what brings you out? Metta, loving kindness. That sort of brings people out of the places inside themselves where they hide. Now, I'm not quite sure what it feels like to be autistic, but maybe there's a lot to be said that there's a lot of fear there, fear to engage. And so it's much more comfortable and secure to be inside and never come out. I don't know, that's just maybe some insights just from a dream a long time ago, which I still remember. Could have been a past life, I'm not sure, and just the images transformed and interpreted from my experience of my early life. Who knows? Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, I've seen beautiful, gorgeous relics in Bodhinyana Monastery's meditation hall. I'm a little curious where those relics came from. When I was a kid, I've heard that relics just come to good, virtuous places. Indeed, some of them have come by themselves. Now, sometimes, you know, with the first ones, that's an interesting story, that I think it was in Singapore, there was a Burmese monk came to see me and he wanted to give me some relics to take back to Perth. He'd heard that I was a good monk and was teaching, had a good reputation. And he announced himself that he'd spent much of his life travelling in upcountry Burma. And he was looking for old stupas where they would keep these relics, you know, these old pagodas. Which were in the jungle, because if you ever go to Burma, there's just so many old stupas there, chedis sometimes they call them. They were really into building these things, and most of them have relics in them, but some have got lost in the jungle over the centuries, and they've got destroyed. The jungle just brings them down. And so he went to remote places, and always on the lookout, if any villager had gone deep into the jungle hunting sometimes animals or just hunting for herbs, and if they come across any of these old, very old destroyed stupas in the jungle. And he said one time he was in the village, he heard a villager had become rich, and that's always a good sign, so he went up to him and said, what happened? And he said he found one of these old stupas, and in it was a gold casket. Inside the casket was the relics. He threw the relics away, but he kept the casket. And that's where he got his money from. And so the monk gave him some more money, lead me to where this was. And so he led him to the relic, the old broken down brick stupa, and he could collect a few relics from there, you know, from where he'd thrown them away. And that's actually what he did. And he would collect these relics, you know, from these old stupas, and he'd give them to good monks like myself. And so he gave me a whole heap of them, that to bring back to Perth. The problem was getting them through customs. Because if you come, now for those of you who've recently come into Perth, you fill out the customs forms. And one of the things you have to ask, have you got any human remains? And so I tick yes, you know, the yes box. So of course, you know, you don't go straight through if you've ticked you've got human remains in your baggage. So they said, let's have a look, what have you got? And I got these, you know, all in sort of enclosed in these little glass cases. So I got these human remains of the Buddha. And the guy looked at me and he said, oh, stay here. Got the supervisor. Because as a monk, you've got to be honest. You know, and I always think honesty is always the best policy. So it was human remains, the Buddha's remains. And they got the supervisor, it was too difficult for this guy. The supervisor said, what's up? He said, this mug has got human remains. These are relics of the Buddha 2,500 years ago. And he had to look at them, all sealed up. He said, this is too difficult, get out of here. It went through straight away, no problem at all. Now, simply, you know, he saw it was all sealed up, so it's not dangerous, not going to have any sort of diseases or bacteria coming in. And it was relics of the Buddha. So those are many of them from there. We also get other ones. But it's also the case that sometimes that you put them in the little the case and they're all sealed up. You never sort of go in there and sort of open them up. And you count them today, you know, there's three, and you count them tomorrow, there's four. And that's really freaky when that happens to people. I think some of those relics, Was it some of those or some other? I think we've got some relics from here to give to the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. You know, the BF over there, because you know, they're mostly intellectuals, business people, and so they're moving into a new center. Have some relics. And they took them, but you can see that they weren't all that impressed. That's not the sort of Buddhism they wanted to practice. But then they took them anyway. And it was only a week later, they sort of emailed or rang up, all excited. You know those two Mahamoggallana relics you gave us? I said, yeah. There's three now. And they were really impressed, because that's the first time I saw anything which was mildly supernatural, you know, in that Singapore group. And it happens very often. But there was also the Buddhist Society of Victoria. I know there's a couple of people from there who come over. Their president, some years ago, he was taking me to a retreat, a long time ago, so you won't know who this president is. As he was taking me into the car, he just confessed that he had been given a relic, I think, by a Thai monk. And he was one of these really intellectuals. I think he'd written a book about Buddhism somewhere. And so he was one of these highly educated, sort of intellectual Buddhists with not much faith. And so he said, when he was given this relic, okay, I'll take it to the temple when I've got time. And he just put it in his cupboard for a whole year. And then he remembered, oh yeah, I've got to take that silly old relic to the temple. But when he looked inside the chamber, it was gone. And that really spooked him. His relic had disappeared. Because he just kept it in the wardrobe. You know, didn't really respect it at all. And that's the other thing which happens. If you don't respect the relics, they vanish. If you respect them, look after them, they multiply. Weird, but true. I've seen, other people have seen it too. Dear Ajahn, but anyway, those aren't the real relics of the Buddha. What are the real relics of the Buddha? Yes, you've heard all my trick questions again before, so never mind. It's the real relics of the Buddha are the teachings, not the bits of bone. We respect those, but the real relics are the teachings. Because there's a very good sutra called the Dhammadayada Sutra, which literally means heirs to the Dhamma. And he told his monks and nuns and lay people, do not be heirs to my material things. Be heirs to my teachings. So if you have a Buddha's old bowl or robe or something, that's not what the Buddha wanted you to respect and revere. He wanted you to respect the teachings. So be an heir to my teachings. Don't inherit the physical stuff. So the robes and stuff, so the relics, yeah, they're interesting, and they, you know, they can give you some inspiration, but the real relics are the teachings. That's what the Buddha bequeathed to us. Dear Ajahn, was Saturn when Venerable Gumbin differentiated between Western nuns and nuns from traditional Buddhist families? They're all daughters of the Buddha. Now both cultures need to mix at both Santi and Dhammasara monasteries. If the Dhammasara nuns are not yet ready for public ceremonies, etc., shouldn't we respect that stand? Yeah. Isn't that, the nuns at Dhammasara don't take a stand, they usually sit down. After all, sorry. After all, their first aim is to find liberation. Both cultures have plus and minus factors in Sangha communities. Is Dhammasara into rituals? Now, that sometimes a ritual is good. Sometimes, if you understand what the ritual means. That's why they're bowing to the Buddha statue. What does that mean? Why do we bow to the Buddha statue? And I mentioned before, it's the first time you bow to virtue. This is what I do. This is how I bow. First time to virtue, second time to peace, third time to compassion. Because I worship those things. And because I remember I'm bound not to a statue, I'm bound to virtue, I'm bound to peace, I'm bound to compassion. It means I keep remembering how important those things are, and that's why those things grow in me. For Australians, Westerners, now we've had it sort of conditioned into us, do not bow to idols. That's in Christianity. And that's such a sort of a conditioning that we feel really, really uncomfortable at first bowing to anything. And because of that, that, you know, all you need to do is say, you're not bowing to an idol. It's not a god. No, it's what it symbolizes. So you bow to virtue, peace, and compassion. And when I explain that to people, you get all these non-Buddhists bowing all over the place because they realize what they're doing and the importance of it. And many of the other rituals which we do, we should always understand why we do those things. I did say the ritual of taking your shoes off so you don't throw them at me when I tell a bad joke. So there's many other rituals that, look, you know, with, please apologize, you know, to you for this particular ritual, but why is it in Chinese temples, when they put the incense in the holder, they go shaking it before they put it in the holder? Because I never saw that in Thai temples or in Sri Lankan temples. If you go to any Chinese temple, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and see everybody getting their incense, shaking it, and then putting it in the incense. I couldn't understand where that came from until I thought, because I got it now. The reason is because whether you're in Thailand, Sri Lanka, Hong Kong, Taiwan, or whatever, the first time, do you remember the first time traditional Buddhists get taken to the temple? It's by your grandmother. And it's true, she shows you what to do, and you just follow her. And your poor old grandmother, she has Parkinson's. And when she puts, you know, the incense into the stick, she's shaking it because, you know, she's got Parkinson's. And the young 3 or 4 year old, 6 year old daughter, she says, oh, grandma does that, so she does that too. And puts it in. That's where that tradition came from. So some of the rituals have got no meaning at all. Some have meaning, but you don't know the meaning. And so you shouldn't follow it unless you understand what you're doing or why you're doing it. But if you know the ritual and you know the meaning, it can be very helpful. Well, why do you get married? Have a marriage ceremony. Because the ritual makes a very important affirmation in front of all the people you like, your relations, your friends, that you are committing to someone. The ritual is very important. Why do you have a ritual when somebody dies? It's incredible. It costs so much money and it just takes people away from doing other things when you have these funerals. So I've actually told people, I told the monks, when I die, please no funeral, no sort of ceremony. All you need to do is, it's usually on a Thursday night, put me in the yellow recycling bin and let them take me away. It's recycling. And it's just much, much better. They take you down to the tip. And the birds and other things eat you, and it's a much better way of going. Would you do that for me?
Yes.
No, you won't. Those are empty words. Because the reason is that, you know, we need to do a ceremony, a ritual for someone we love and care for. Now, you won't do that to your old mum when she dies. You know, you just want to send her off and say, look, no, we really love you, care for you, you've made a big impact on our life, mum. So, you know, we wanted to give you something. And that's actually why we have rituals for. You know, rituals are just taking something which exists in our heart, putting it out into something physical so we could express it in a much easier way. So we do have rituals in Buddhism, but we don't have too many rituals. And for Dhammasara Monastery and Santi Monastery, they're young monasteries. They're finding their way. They're finding their little niche and just how they're going to do things. So, now, Dhammasara and Santi Monastery over in south of Sydney, and even and the Newbury Monastery in Melbourne, they're just young monasteries. They're finding just their way. So give them a chance to find out how much ritual, how much meditation, how much work, and how to do things. And eventually you just find their way. And the same Asian or sort of Australian, Europeans. I keep telling you, we're all Asians. We are either Asian or Caucasian, but we're all Asians. And but sometimes, you know, some people actually say that Asians are different than Westerners. And I spent 9 years in Asia, in northeast Thailand. And That was a special case because the northeast of Thailand, as you Thai girls would know, had never been colonized by the West. It was an indigenous Asian culture. Different than Sri Lanka, which had been colonized by, first of all, was the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British. And then Malaysia had been colonized. Singapore was almost was created by the British, just about. So many of those cultures, you know, have been influenced by the West. The northeast of Thailand was indigenous. And I, you know, went to some places. It was such a boring country. It was a flat plain and not very fertile, which meant that no tourists went up there. They went up to Chiang Mai, they went to the beaches in the south, but never up to the northeast. There was nothing there. And because of that, I remember one village in particular where I was the first white man the village had ever seen, a big village, a couple of thousand people, when I turned up on Alms Round to see a white man. The first time I'd ever seen a white man. And I remember because they were putting food in my bowl with the other Thai monks. And they're always supposed to, you've been taught this, the Thai girls here, always to put, don't look at the monk's face, but put the food in the monk's bowl. These girls. And they kept missing the bowl. The rice kept falling outside because they were paying no attention to the first white man they see, let alone white monks. So, because of that, and because you were put into a role which was understood in the culture of a monk, you were totally accepted. You weren't some sort of outsider like someone doing some aid work in the community. You were an insider, so you learned the culture from the inside. And from anthropologists, that was such a privileged position to be, inside the community, accepted, and seeing how everything worked. And you see, it doesn't matter a bit whether you're Asian or whether you're Australian or English or French or whatever. Human beings are exactly the same. You know, laugh at the same things. Just want a bit of respect and happiness and just joy. And it's beautiful to see a culture from the inside and understand there's no difference between a boy born up in sort of England going to Cambridge and then a person who's born in a village and living in sort of the northeast of Thailand. No difference at all. So that's why, I don't believe in sort of cultures. Whether it's Asia or I've just been around Asians too much to realize, to understand them enough and understand that we're just the same. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I've been getting pretty violent nightmares since my mind has become calm from meditating. Is this common? Why does this happen? Brilliant. Now you get very violent nightmares. Please get a paper and pencil, like a big pad, and then in the morning write them down. This could be the great script for the next blockbuster. People like violent movies. You make a lot of money from that. We can pay off all the debts for Nubri Monastery, get a sort of a nice buildings in Santi and everywhere else. So whoever's having those, please write them down. There's a $1 million script there. I can always see Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, your stars in your violent nightmares. Now, all it really is because you're being so calm during the day. It's just a bit of extra energy coming out at night time. So that's all it is. But what you can do is if you've had enough of the violent nightmares, tell yourself when you go to sleep at night, you're laying down, you're just about to go to sleep, just you program your mindfulness. Say, tonight, no violent nightmares, I'll have comedies. And if you program that into your mind, it's incredible how well it works. But actually, I should say, don't have comedies, because I've done that before, and you wake up in the middle of the night laughing your head off. And people have done that. I mean, a couple of retreats ago, someone did that, and they woke up in the middle of life laughing, and everybody in the room, in the other cottages, came up, they woke up and said, what's going on, what's going on? They're laughing their head off in the middle of the night. So you can actually mess around with your dreams. But if you come here and your partner's here, please, no romantic nightmares, okay? Otherwise you get in trouble with your partner. Can you explain ahosi karma? Karma negates other karma. Also, thank you very much for a very inspiring retreat. Ahosi karma literally means karma that was. It specifically means, you know, that the karma which would have usually come up, but now you're a stream winner, you can't get that bad karma anymore. Now you're cut off from the karma. And you may all have read that a person who becomes a stream winner can no longer get reborn in the lower realm. And I, you know, because I'm a Westerner trained, I thought, why? Why not? And it never actually says why. You know, that this is well known, that, you know, if you're a stream winner, the very worst thing is a human being, a heavenly realm, but you can't be reborn as an animal or a ghost or something low like that anymore. Why? And the answer is that basically a stream winner has gone beyond guilt and punishment. We're trying to encourage you to do that before, but really it's not, this whole idea of guilt and punishing yourself makes absolutely no sense. Traditionally, those people who, you know, have gone to the temples and been told by monks that when you die, you'll be judged by this god called Yama. And if you've been bad, you will be sent down to hell. And sometimes you go to some of these Chinese temples. I remember this next month I'm going to the Chi Wen Cave or something in the Genting Highlands to teach a retreat. And they've got this big exhibit there, these pictures of all the different hells you can go to, with these heavenly beings, they're sending you to hell, they're judging you. And people love seeing that stuff. Even the kids love it because it's people being skewered and blood everywhere and stuff like that. Why do people love that stuff? Because you're weird. Why is it in Thai temples they always have these, you know, that's what people go and see first of all. You know, the heavenly stuff, you know, they don't want to see that. They want to see all the people being tortured and skewered and boiled alive and stuff like that. Human beings have got a really weird sort of sense of excitement. But anyway, I could never figure it out. How could a heavenly being send anyone to a place like that? I could never do that. Could you do that? And you're a human being. Now, could you send a person to sort of centuries of punishment? If that was me, I'd say, no one's looking, get out of here, quick. You know, the back door out of hell is over there. No one's looking, quick, 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 quick. Because you're kind. And you, devas are high-minded people. So I thought, how could this work? How could anyone be sent to hell? And I soon figured out, you can send yourself to hell. That's the only one who can send you to a place like that, yourself. Because you think you deserve to be punished. You think that you're not good enough. You are guilty. And guilt means punishment. And so that's what people do. And the only person who ever sends you to hell is yourself. For however long you think you need. But, you know, that's a totally ridiculous thing to do. I think it's in one of the books there. The doors of hell are always open. You can walk out whenever you want. But people don't want to walk out because they feel they haven't done enough penance yet. And that's a very weird state for the human being. But when you become a stream winner, that state is totally abolished, eradicated. You don't do punishment anymore, penance. So you never send yourself to hell. You never send yourself to a lower realm anymore. You don't need to anymore. You've seen enough of non-self not to do that. So that karma is now let go of. Why can't we let go of the past? You know, in doing meditation, we try and make you let go of the past temporarily, just while you're meditating. But it comes back afterwards. Why can't you just say, I made a mistake, okay? Let it go. Why do I have to keep worrying about it? It doesn't make no sense at all. But why can't we do that? Because we literally identify with that act. We think it's I did that. The sense of self. Where there's a sense of self, there's a sense of ownership. And if you own your bad karma, because you think there's a self there, then it will be always bothering you. As soon as you see there's no self, it means no ownership. Then you can let things go. Profoundly. You let them go and they never come back again. That's called ahosi. Karma that was, which can never get back to you. Oh, what joy. As I said to someone, it's like you're in a rowboat. And behind the rope boat is the rowboat is a big rope. And on the end of that rope is this big, big tug full of heavy, heavy stuff called your past. You just got a small rowboat, and there's this big, what's it called? It's freight, not trailer. Barge, thank you. There's this huge barge full of your old karma. And you're towing it up the river. Until one day you think, what the hell am I doing this for? And you just cut the rope. Bye-bye, bad karma. And then you can row with much greater ease to nirvana. How much are you towing behind in your life? Pulling it up, along. And it's just such a burden, your past. Until you actually realize you can just untie it. You can let it go. To realize that can be done is an incredible insight. There's a few psychologists, very senior psychologists, who come to my talks in Perth. And I was talking with one of them. He said this goes totally against what he was taught in psychology school. So you always have to bring up the past and deal with it. And I said, no, you can just let the whole lot go. That's just a very challenging teaching for psychologists. But he's come around and said, yeah, I can understand this. Yeah, that's far, far deeper than anything you can hear in universities. Just let the whole thing go in one hit. That's called a hosikama. Anyway, next question. I've spent many years at university studying science and engineering, so I've been educated to understand that the best part of determining the truthfulness of an idea or phenomenon is through evidence provided by the scientific method. While I accept and believe in most Buddhist ideas and concepts, perhaps because of my scientific training, I have difficulty accepting some of the more esoteric ideas in Buddhism, such as psychic supernatural powers and reincarnation. Did you have a similar difficulty accepting such concepts when you changed from your early scientific training to Buddhism? Is it necessary to believe in such things to be Buddhist? How should I work with my skeptical mind? Thank you. Now, first of all, science. It's nice if you can actually get hold of Rupert Sheldrake's book, The Science Delusion. Because there, Professor Sheldrake, he makes this wonderful distinction between scientific method and scientific dogma. And it's a very good distinction to make, because scientific method is always challenging everything. It's actually science began not by trying to prove a theory, but trying to disprove it. Because it's very hard to prove things, but it's easy to disprove things. Find the fault, find the place where it doesn't work, and then you realize that theory is not accurate, it needs to be refined. To prove it, all you know that you haven't found the anomaly yet, you haven't found the case which disproves it. So I always started with a way of disproof. But now, that scientific method, which is not practiced as much as it should be, because of scientific dogma, there are some things which you're not allowed to challenge. But science should be to challenge everything. And so to challenge things, in his book, one of the things he states really struck a chord with me, because it took me back 45 years to Cambridge University when the Lucasian Professor of Physics was a fellow called Professor Fred Hoyle. And it was the 100th anniversary of the Cambridge University Astronomical Society. It was one of the clubs I joined when I first went to Cambridge. So I managed to get into the biggest lecture theatre in the whole of Cambridge, which is a chemistry lab. So I went past it a couple of weeks ago. And I made a mistake of getting the time wrong. I went an hour early, which was the only way I could get a seat. Because the lecture from Fred Hoyle, there's two lecturers, the B lecture, there was a guy who discovered quasars. That was the B lecture. And the A lecture was Fred Hoyle. And the reason why it was packed is that guy could lecture. And not only brilliant, but his mind was just a wonder to behold at work. It was like looking at somebody composing a symphony, looking at some Beethoven in the progress of creating his fifth. Incredible to watch. And not just physicists, everybody, from the university, the architects, the philosophers, they were all packed into this this auditorium to listen to this guy. And he just threw out all these incredible ideas, and you're on the edge of the seat all the time. It was, you know, intellectually, it was the best entertainment I've ever had. So stimulating. His brain was just amazing. And one of the things, he was questioning everything, even basic assumptions of science. One of them, why is it that this universal gravitational constant should be constant? Who said it's constant? It's just a theory, that's all. If you want to know what that means, go back to your high school science, gravity, Newton's law of gravity. The attraction between two massive bodies is equal to the product of their masses divided by the square of the distance apart times big G, the universal gravitational constant, which is supposed to be a constant. And Hoyle said, why? Perhaps it's not. And then that's the last I heard about it. It's amazing little ideas, just opening up new areas of physics. You can just explore. It was like a wonderland. I forgot all about that until the Sheldrake came and said the same thing. Why does big G has to be constant? That's just a dogma. And what he did, which was incredible, was, you know, I don't know why other people haven't thought of this before, but there are institutes in every country which measures these standards. And when I was in Sydney, the Australian Institute of Physics, they were holding their seminar at CSIRO in Linfield in Sydney. That was also the place they measure things in Australia. So they do measurements. Boring, these are probably second-rate scientists, you know, because all they do is measure these quantities. You know, they're not breakthroughs, it's just bread-and-butter work, you know, to measure the speed of light, and measure, the weight or the time a cesium atom takes to decay, and measure sort of big G. And so he went to many of these laboratories throughout the world who measure standards, got all the information of the last 50 years, and found out that big G does change. It changes in London, New York, Australia, exactly the same amount, changes for different years. And that change is significant. It's not a small amount, it's a big amount. So your school science is wrong. G is not a constant. But when he tries to say that, he first of all gave a lecture on TEDx channel. If you know TEDx internet channel, it's a place where people can actually put sort of strange, weird, challenging ideas. He is the only person ever to be banned. He gave his talk and then it was dropped from TEDx channel. And then he went on some other sort of media and said, see, I proved my point. Science is dogmatic. They banned me. And that's why I heard about it, and that's where his book became very popular. There are many people in science who are very dogmatic. They are not scientists anymore. Now, psychic phenomena. What's the evidence? Your beliefs have to be put aside. Evidence is more important. So if you see sort of the relics increase in the reliquary, how that happens is secondary. You've seen it happen. That is a psychic phenomena. Reincarnation. If you see convincing evidence, somebody comes along and says, I remember my past life. There's no way they can get the evidence in any other way. It checks out. That is hard evidence. And there is huge amounts of that hard evidence. So much so that somebody sent me a YouTube video of this Professor Alvarez. He was a professor of philosophy at some university in the United States, a good university. And he was saying he just read Professor Ian Stevenson's research, you know, on reincarnation. And he said this was very high quality science. It was done rigorously, trying to eliminate sort of faults of evidence. Because this professor, he had done lots of research in psychology and in medicine, psychiatry. He knew his stuff. He knew how to do research. And he said, as a philosopher, there's no other conclusion but to say reincarnation has been proved. The evidence is compelling. You have to accept it, unless you can come up with a better explanation of the evidence. No better explanation has come up. It's proved. Now, the problem with science, and the reason I'm labouring this point, because it's a passion with me, is that it was Carl Sagan who came up with this terrible saying that extraordinary propositions need extraordinary evidence. So, who decides what's extraordinary? The scientists, people like Sagan. So reincarnation is put in the extraordinary basket. Why? Because it doesn't fit with their philosophy. And once you say it's extraordinary, then they demand extraordinary evidence, which is impossible evidence. Now, you compare that to something else. Say, the Higgs boson, the God particle, which, have you heard about the Higgs boson, the God particle? In CERN?
Goddamn.
Yeah.
It was not God, it was
Goddamn.
Goddamn,
no. Yeah.
Yeah. And he wanted to take this goddamn particle.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And the publisher didn't want that. He put God.
God particle, yeah. But it is actually called, known by most people as the God particle, the Higgs boson. And you know, there was a, because this is why I asked, do you know this? You're not scientists. But most people in the world knew that it was supposed to be discovered at CERN. And I was in Hamburg recently, I was on to this. And they sent me back, look, don't say it's been discovered. Because he works at CERN. One of the engineers there. It has not been discovered. He said, the evidence is still a bit dodgy. It may be. We're not sure about it yet. And as much other things has been discovered which throw the whole of that part of physics into disarray. Things which should not be there, which have been there. But as far as the Higgs boson is concerned, it's not CERN. This is a scientist. Time magazine, no, it's been discovered. Most scientists, it's been discovered. They've even awarded 2 Nobel Prizes in physics for the founders of it. This is not extraordinary evidence, but something they really wanted to find. And so when it's something you want to find, it's not extraordinary evidence, but even lower than convincing evidence is enough to get you the Nobel Prize. And I'm mentioning here because it's not a level playing field. Science does not play fair. If it's something they don't want to believe, the bar of proof is so high, it's impossible to prove. And that's what they've done with reincarnation. They've raised the bar so high that no one can actually meet that requirement. But something like the Higgs boson, the bar is so low, because they really, 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 really want to prove it. Science is biased. And I say it as a scientist. They decide what extraordinary evidence is, and they decide what they want. They decide what they want to prove and what they don't want to prove. It's just like, you know, please excuse me, sir, like in the United States, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, a black African United States person could not get a fair trial. The standard of evidence required for a white person and a black African was totally uneven. And that's happening in science right now. So the standards of proof are just bent. And that's one of the reasons why myself, it's also good old Sam Harris, who spent most of his time destroying religions, really criticizing Buddhism as well. Now he's turned on science. Science has got many of the, and I say this as science, much of science is great, but science has got a bit too proud and arrogant, and it's lost its scientific method and become far too dogmatic, especially in things like consciousness studies. So anyway, that's the thing in reincarnation. I've seen psychic phenomena. You can't, look, it's there. My goodness. How on earth can you say it's not there? So, there we go. So that's what happened to me. You see these things. I was a real scientist, evidence-based. And I don't care what belief you have. If the evidence proves otherwise, you've got to abandon your belief. Never allow your beliefs to stand in the way of truth. You've got to bend the beliefs to fit the evidence, not the other way around. But science, many religions as well, they bend the evidence to fit what they want to find. That's unacceptable. Anyway, there we go. That's my rant for today. Dear Brother Ajahn Brahm, what is the natural end of a meditation? The natural end of a meditation is sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. No, the natural end, you just fade away. There's no end. There's no beginning. It just goes round. Before, it was often an overwhelming sleepiness that stopped my meditation. But now I can handle sleepiness better, so I'm sometimes unsure when to stop and how to stop the meditation. Mostly at some point, the bodily feelings are becoming more prominent again, and usually that's where I stop them. Thank you for an explanation. Sometimes it's a good question, where do you stop? One of the reasons I don't ring the bells here, because that, you know, makes you actually to feel, is it the right time to stop or should I carry on? One nice little practice for you is when you feel like stopping meditation, just say another 5 minutes and see what happens. So you feel like you're stopping, so another 5 minutes. Because what that does, that extends the meditation, and sometimes you think you should stop and you shouldn't. It's just a little bit of boredom or just sometimes even fear getting really deep. So another 5 minutes is always a very good little suggestion to yourself. When you're coming out, no, another 5 minutes. You never lose anything, but you gain a lot by that little thing. And after a while, you feel, if you've been meditating for a long time, you feel, this has had enough now. You become very skillful, not looking at the clock, but feeling, yeah, this is the time to come out. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you recommend any books about the Buddha written for lay people? I mean, people who are interested in the life and times and history of the Buddha, but don't want to become Buddhist. Why is he called the Buddha? Do we know the name that he was born with? Thank you. Why don't you want to become Buddhist? Be open. Who knows? You can become a Chris Buddhist or a Buddhist. Why do you even call yourself a name like this? Be open. If you find something which is truthful, follow it. Why do people have to have an allegiance to something? So, because having allegiance, I'm, say, a Christian, so I can't bow. I really like to bow, but I can't. It's bad for me, but I really want to. So don't allow those sorts of labels to stop you. I'm a Buddhist, so I can't enjoy Christmas. I can't have a Christmas tree. I really want one. Yes. Don't allow any labels to stop you finding goodness and joy and happiness and truth wherever you find it. That's why there are even some of the greatest little stories of Nasruddin. He's a Sufi scholar. He's a Muslim. I love telling Nasruddin stories. What's one of the Nasruddin stories? This is young people story. Because Nasruddin... Okay, there's two stories. They keep coming out. Really good ones. Nasruddin, he had a son, a teenager. And the teenager would never follow his father. If his father said to do something, the teenager would do completely the opposite. And, for an example, Nasruddin had a salt trade. He'd take salt from one place to another and sell it. That was his business. And on the journey, they always had to cross these bridges, and sometimes they were very narrow. And if he saw the donkey carrying the salt, because it may not have been properly balanced, or the balance might have shifted, leaning to the left over the bridge, Nasruddin would tell his son, push the donkey further to the left. And it was leaning to the left, push it further to the left, because he knew his son would do the opposite and push it to the right, thereby keep it balanced. So if the donkey was leaning to the right, Nasruddin would say, push the donkey to the right. And the son would push it to the left, and that thereby get balanced. And everything was going well until one day, it was crossing a bridge, the donkey was leading to the right, and Nasruddin said as usual, push the donkey to the right, son. And the son pushed it to the right, and the donkey fell in. And then Nasruddin said, what do you do that for? He said, don't you remember, father, today is my 21st birthday. I'm not a teenager anymore. And that is a joke about young people from Iran or Persia, I don't know how many years ago. Nasruddin was about 800, 900 years ago, I think, wasn't he? Somewhere around that. a long time ago. So that was one joke. But the other story was my predecessor Ajahn Chakra's favorite story. And it's very profound. And that was Nasruddin was in front of a big pile of chili peppers. You know, the red ones, the hot ones. And he'd already eaten so many. You know, his face was red. The snot was coming out of his nose. His eyes were very watery. And he was putting another chili in his mouth. And his friend said, "What are you doing that for?" And Nasruddin replied, "I'm looking for the sweet one." Does that sound similar to you in your life? Always looking for the sweet one. I'm looking for the sweet meditation. And it's always hot when you're looking for sweet stuff. I'm looking for the perfect partner. They always burn you. They're hot. But I'm looking for the sweet one. And that was such a really great simile. That was Nasruddin. So sometimes, just because it's a Muslim, don't think, "Oh, I'm not going to read any of that stuff." Wherever you found some wisdom, follow it. So can I recommend any books about the Buddha written for lay people? I mean, people are interested in the life and times of the history of the Buddha. Please do not read Karen Armstrong's book. You know, she did a book about the Buddha, and it's a very bad book. It's very, very demeaning and inaccurate as well. So, a book about the Buddha. Which one? Any suggestions, Venables? Sorry? Rahula. Who?
Rahula.
Rahula. Oh, Walpole Rahula.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's good, yeah. Yeah, so, find Walpole Rahula. Who else has written a book about the Buddha? Siddhartha, yeah, but that's not really, that's a novel, that's not really exactly what happened. He made up a lot in that book. But in there's lots of little books. Find one from a modern writer, no, not someone too old, and you can find it there. Much love for the nuns last evening. They had to follow Jimi Hendrix. Who's Jimi Hendrix? For those of you living in Perth, in about, what day is today? Yeah, almost a month's time, on the 31st of December, you know, we have Ajahn Brahm's party. And I think, I'm not sure I've advertised it already. Too often on New Year's Eve, some of the members of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia complain and say, you know, we keep breaking our precepts on New Year's Eve because we get invited to a party and they always serve alcohol. And you know, we've got no, it's New Year's Eve, we've got to go somewhere. So to help people, I said, well, I'm going to start Ajahn Brahm's party. That's been, how many years has that been going now? 20 years or something? But anyway, have Ajahn Brahm's party on New Year's Eve. So there's no alcohol, a bit of fun and games. And one of the fun and games we did a couple of years ago, I flashed a picture on the board. Who's this? Because somebody had sent this photo to me. They'd gone to Photoshop, and from the neck down, it was Jimi Hendrix. From the neck up, it was Ajahn Brahm. It was totally disrespectful, but I loved it. It was Jimi Brahm. I still got it somewhere. Was that being published in any one of those books about me? We should publish it one day, because it was really quite funny. Jimi Brahm, but sometimes people think it's too disrespectful. But anyway, I am Jimi Hendrix. So well done, nuns, yesterday. You got good rap. Dear Ajahn, you said that we have to work since Monday to get our paycheck on Friday. How come my friend has a nimitta every time he sits, though he's just a newbie? Thank you. He's a friend of the boss. Sometimes people have been working much longer so that they are on a higher salary. So they get a paycheck very often. Some of you have just begun work, which means you don't get paid so much. And some of you, instead of being working, you've been slacking off. So your pay has been docked. But everybody gets a paycheck sooner or later, so just be patient. What is the difference in approach between wanting and resolution? On the night of his awakening, the Buddha said to be made a very strong resolution to himself. Why did he do that? It's interesting, did he really do that? Like, no, I'm going to, The resolution was, for those who haven't heard this, he said, even though my blood dries up, even though my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this spot until I have gained complete, utter freedom from suffering, nibbana. I know that I heard that saying the very first Vaisak which I went to at Cambridge University in May. And I was so impressed. So, what an amazing resolution. Sort of, I will not move no matter what happens until I become enlightened. So after the little ceremony in the afternoon, I went back to my room. I'd only been meditating about 3 months, but I thought, well, if the Buddha can do it, why not me? It's a crazy guy. So I sat down in my room, and with all seriousness, total solemnity, no joke, I sat down on my meditation cushions. And said, right, this is it. And I've got a busy life. I've got to get enlightenment out of the way so I can do other things. So I'm not going to move from this spot in my room in college. Even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move. This is it. And I'd usually meditate 25 minutes. 30 minutes was a pretty good sit. I managed actually 40 minutes, by which time I was in such agony. I couldn't stand another moment. So I opened my eyes and I was really disappointed. My blood hadn't dried yet and I was not enlightened at all. And I realized that's what a stupid thing that was. Maybe a Buddha can do that because he knows what he's doing. But not you, not me. So be careful of such willpower. It's not willpower, it's a wisdom power. One thing the Buddha did know, he tried willpower for 6 years. And the ascetic practices. And he realized that's not the way. And then he put his bowl in the river Nirmala, one of the big rivers going past Bodh Gaya. He made a resolution, if I'm to be enlightened, may my bowl not go with the current, but go against the current. And it did. It was supposed to be an omen, but it's also a description of what he had to do. Don't go with the current of craving. Stop. Don't let craving move you. And that's a very powerful thing, stopping. So the bowl never went with the current. It was immune to the power and the force of craving. The winds of craving never moved the bowl. And that's how he became enlightened. Stopping. Not wanting anything. No craving. Being still. You can understand, I want to be enlightened is craving. I'm not going to move. He's craving. So that may have been the beginning when he just sat down. But what happened next was not will. What is your last advice for us before we leave and go back to daily life? Wait until tomorrow. In one of your talks you have spoken about many to one to none. Can you explain more on this? Thank you, with metta. Oh, it was just sometimes you have duality and then you have non-duality in Advaita Vedanta. And I think that's the end. But it goes the next step in Buddhism. From many or from duality to non-duality to non-non-duality. From two to one. Sometimes people, they want to actually to be at one with all things. And we go deeper than that, to be at none with all things. Though did I tell the story of the schizophrenic Buddhist? The one with the split personality? Now you get that joke? You know, they didn't want to be one with everything because they had divided personality. So their goal in life was to be two with everything. I thought that was very funny when I first heard that one. Never mind. So anyway, you can see just even the idea of like many gods, and to some religions to have a single god, a single sort of cause, a single power. And we go beyond that Buddhism to nothing, to emptiness. Now that's in meditation what happens. Sometimes they say, what do you mean by non-duality in actually Buddhism? Now you do have an object, a subject, you do have a sense of width in most of your meditations.